The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Vasculitides and Osteoarthritis is presented by Dr. Robert DiGiovanni.
I went on the app for the ACOI today, and I see you all have books, but I also saw that all of these are available on your app as well. So if you're, you know, hooked into Marriott Guest or Marriott Conference and you want to go to the app, and you can pull up all these slide packets. Okay, so at any rate, if I go over a little bit on this one, I think it's okay because we had extra time from the last one. This is going to be a discussion of vasculitis, again, centered around three case presentations of types of vasculitis you're most likely going to see and when you should start thinking about a patient having a systemic vasculitis. Again, no disclosures. We put none in larger letters here. You should understand the clinical features and presentations of commonly tested vasculitides. Differentiate between different vasculitic conditions based on presentation, and management and treatment of vasculitis as well. Okay, our first case. This is a 71-year-old female with high blood pressure, high cholesterol. She has new onset right-sided throbbing headaches and weight loss of 10 pounds over 2 weeks. On exam, she has tenderness over the right temporal artery, otherwise not a very remarkable exam, or visual fields may be intact to confrontation, and so on. On lab, she has a very high SED rate, 87. She's anemic, a normochromic, normocytic anemia. What is her most likely diagnosis? Anybody go for a stroke, CVA? Anybody go for giant cell arteritis? Okay. Anybody go for migraine or cancer? Well, with a SED rate elevation like that, you should check an SPEP, but this is giant cell arteritis. Giant cell arteritis is granulomatous inflammation that affects the medium and large arteries. In younger individuals, there's a similar disease called Takayasu's, but we're not going to spend a lot of time on that because it's rather rare. External carotid branches, ophthalmic, vertebral, distal subclavian, axillary arteries, and thoracic aorta are the most common. But it can affect any blood vessel anywhere in the body. It's just the predilection for vessels that come off the aortic arch are more common. Peak incidence is in the eighth decade of life, with women being slightly higher than men. It's highest in white individuals of Northern European descent, and like RA, is associated with HLA-DR4 and HLA-DRB1 histocompatibility types. So what are some of the symptoms that one's going to see with giant cell arteritis? So headache, especially over the temples. Jaw claudication, that's been in the literature now kind of adjudicated as the most specific feature of giant cell arteritis. So this is not in contradistinction to having TMJ, where, you know, the joint hurts with chewing food, with mastication. It's really a claudicational type of pain where the muscles, like the masseter and so forth, or the tongue or even, might start aching after they're chewing food for a little while because it's an ischemic myopathy. It's not getting a blood supply. Scalp tenderness, they may complain of pain on the scalp when they're even combing their hair. They can have ear pain, neck pain, and sore throat. This is a systemic vasculitis, don't forget. So they can have fever, weight loss, and malaise, anorexia. Visual loss can be transient, like amaurosis fugax, or it can be permanent. But typically, if it's amaurosis, they may be just intermittently catching the posterior ciliary arteries or branches of the central retinal artery. Diplopia, binocular diplopia, if you catch any of the small extraocular muscles. Cranial nerve palsies may occur, and ischemic myopathies may occur as well. So what labs are you going to order? All right, everybody knows we're going to order a SED rate and C-reactive protein for these individuals. An SPEP, because a monoclonal gammopathy can mimic musculoskeletal diseases if you've got multiple myeloma, and it can cause very high SED rates. CBC, you might see thrombocytosis, and you're going to see anemia, usually mild, normochromic, and normocytic. And then a CMP, very common to see elevated alkaline phosphatase. Okay, so what we would do in a case like this, we would start prednisone at 60 milligrams right off the bat and refer her for a temporal artery biopsy. We don't wait for the temporal artery biopsy. We start the steroids right away. So this is actually from Johns Hopkins Medicine here in Baltimore. And the image on the left shows a cross-section of a temporal artery with a dense inflammatory infiltrate in the media of the vessel. And you can see there's really no lumen because there's been intimal hyperplasia and the lumen is occluded. And on the right, we see multinucleated giant cell. What about temporal artery biopsies? The temporal artery biopsy should be at least a centimeter and a half long because there's a lot of skip lesions and you can have a sampling error. And then you should multiply section the biopsy. The biopsy is usually going to be positive about 90% of the time, so negative biopsy doesn't necessarily rule it out. But I still think it's the best way to go because months down the road when you're getting steroid complications, at least you know what you're treating, that you've had a positive biopsy. The diagnostic sensitivity of temporal artery biopsy remains high even after steroid therapy has been initiated. It declines after the first 2 to 6 weeks, okay? But typically they can find changes even in that first 2 to 6 weeks. Characteristic findings were a panarteritis, most prominent in the media, composed of CD4 containing lymphocytes and macrophages. Positive biopsy may show inflammation of the wall, which is active, or it could show evidence of healed arteritis, and we see that sometime. And the pathologist will comment whether or not there's features like absence of the internal elastic membrane, which is a feature typically of healed arteritis. Another diagnostic tool that you might see in the literature is color Doppler ultrasound with the halo sign. This is a dark circumferential ring around the vascular lumen. It shows mural edema, and it's hyperechoic. Bilateral temporal artery halo sign is highly specific, and if it persists on compression, then that's also highly specific for giant cell arteritis. We don't use this in our clinic at all yet, but I've toyed with the idea. Now, there are variants of giant cell arteritis that you need to be aware of. One is large vessel variant. You should consider this when patients are considered to have giant cell arteritis, but the temporal artery biopsy is negative, and the color Doppler ultrasound may be negative as well. So these, in fact, 50% of the time, you have large vessel involvement, aortitis, and you might see it even on a PET scan, that type of thing, but you don't see it on a temporal artery biopsy. So the aorta and its first branches are often involved, and the symptoms would be aortic arch syndrome with claudication of the arms, absent or asymmetric pulses, paresthesias, and digital ischemia. So these are some pictures of giant cell arteritis of the large cell variant. So what you see in panel A is multiple axial, coronal, and sagittal CT reconstructions of a what's called an elephant trunk graft that's been grafted onto the thoracic aorta, elephant trunk graft, thoracic aorta, to an area of obvious aneurysmal dilatation. So that's pretty impressive. And that was in a 70-some-odd-year-old woman who had biopsy-proven giant cell arteritis. So we know it was giant cell arteritis, and that's how its involvement in the aorta can look. So think about large vessel involvement. And then in the other panel, we see an MR angiogram, same thing, an individual with biopsy-proven giant cell arteritis who's got multiple areas where you can see the arrows of subclavian stenosis, all right? So there's a vasculitis clinic at Hopkins here in Baltimore. I think it's run by a Dr. Seo, who's very well known. And he likes to say, what I've got to his lectures, when a blood vessel gets inflamed, it can do one of two things. It can fight back and stenose, or it can give up and become an aneurysm. So that's why, you know, the common feature that we see here in vasculitis are areas of stenosis or aneurysmal dilatation. So back to the case. The patient's steroids are being tapered, and she gets pain and aching around the proximal muscles and her neck and so forth. What is your differential? Steroid-induced myopathy, osteoarthritis, polymyalgia rheumatica, or infection? Anybody? PMR, right. So PMR is the third presentation, really, of the giant cell arteritis syndrome. It often occurs during the taper for giant cell arteritis. We see pain in the shoulder and hip girdle joints, the rhizomelic joints, malaise, weight loss, sweats, low-grade fever. It's more common than the incidence of giant cell arteritis, about 3 to 10-fold. If you think about it, about 15% of patients with PMR may have associated giant cell arteritis. Alternately, about 85% of patients with giant cell arteritis may develop PMR. So you have to exclude other signs of vascular insufficiency, such as claudication. Listen for bruise over the or the aortic branches and so forth. This also tends to be very, very steroid responsive. Just low doses, 10, 15, 20 milligrams, will often control it. And the fourth presentation of giant cell arteritis is fever wasting syndrome. These are fevers and chills in elderly patients and maybe the cause of FUO in patients over 70 in up to 15% of cases. For your pleasure, these are the 1990 giant cell arteritis ACR classification. Disease onset greater than 50, so it's typically a disease of older individuals. New onset headache, that's very important. Abnormal temporal artery biopsy, SED rates over 50 by Westergaard method, biopsy evidence of a vasculitis with a predominance of mononuclear infiltrate or granulomatous inflammation with multinucleated giant cells. Treatment of giant cell arteritis is glucocorticoids at 60 milligrams of prednisone or the equivalent. Pulse steroids are indicated for vision changes. This is one of those areas in rheumatology where pulse steroids can help. Relief typically occurs within a day or two. It won't reverse interval hyperplasia, but it can decrease ischemic complications by decreasing edema of the vessel. Once clinically stable, you taper by, say, 10% Q1 to 2 weeks, and then it may take actually months and months to taper them off of prednisone, if at all. Tocilizumab is a medication that is now approved as well. And the philosophy of whether to start it right away versus later on, if they fail to taper steroids, it goes back and forth. Low-dose aspirin, some authors recommend it to reduce ischemic complications, but not necessarily using it all the time in our clinic. So here we have a bonus question. A 78-year-old female with a history of biopsy-proven giant cell arteritis is treated with steroids and tapered off. She's doing great for 2 years, and now she has sudden loss of visual loss on the right side. She has jaw pain with chewing food. Her SED rate was 104. What's the best next step? Repeat temporal artery biopsy. Anybody? Start prednisone 60 milligrams. Start pulse dose of methylprednisolone 500 milligrams daily for 3 days. Anybody? I see a few hands, or tocilizumab. Best answer is start pulse steroids. In this individual who's had visual loss, the pulse steroids might help return a little bit of that vision. There's been some studies that suggest that that's possible. So a pulse is whatever you want to define it. It's a 500 milligrams, it's 1,000 milligrams to some people, you know, whatever. So, but that's the answer to that question. All right, let's go on to a second case. You know, when to start thinking of systemic vasculitis. 43-year-old male presents with shortness of breath, nosebleeds, fever, and fatigue. Okay? Well, sounds like a systemic disease. Something's going on. On exam, there is bilateral scleritis. Ulcers are noted in the nares. He has scattered wheezes, and his skin exam is normal. SED rate is 68. His white cell count's elevated, 13.4. He's anemic. His creatinine is elevated to 2.3, and he has red cell casts in his urinary sediment. A chest x-ray shows multiple cavitary lesions. Okay, so let's put this together. First of all, it is a lecture on vasculitis, so I know you're going to probably get this, okay? He's got multi-system disease, upper airway and lower airway. He's got cavitary lesions, and he's got renal involvement. So this is a multi-organ, multi-system disease, all right? So we're talking, of course, about GPA, granulomatosis with polyangiitis, one of the ANCA-associated vasculitides. I'm going to try to clarify ANCAs for you as we go through this. This is a necrotizing granulomatous vasculitis of small arteries of the upper and lower respiratory tree and may cause glomerulonephritis when we have diffuse disease. Prevalence is 3 per 100,000, more common in people of Northern European descent, about even, you know, but males a little more predominant, with fairly young people, again, very involved, 35 to 55 years of age. Rarely see it before adolescence. Main involvement that you might see would be lung with symptoms such as cough, hemoptysis, dyspnea, chest discomfort, and of course, bilateral multiple nodular cavitary infiltrates, very common. Upper airway, we could see parasinus drainage and discharge, purulent or bloody nasal discharge, nasal mucosal ulceration. Sinus and nasopharynx reveal inflammation, necrosis, and granulomatous formation. In the kidneys, we can see proteinuria, hematuria, and cellular casts. And it starts usually as a focal segmental glomerulonephritis, but can rapidly develop into a diffuse crescentic glomerulonephritis. So these are reprinted here, and then this is the classic saddle nose deformity. So this is, and of course, again, nasal septal perforation as well. Rule out cocaine use with levamisole. All right, here's some CT scans of a patient with GPA. You can see an arrow sign on the left showing a thick-walled cavitary lesion in the posterior lobe. So, right there, and there. And then the one on the right is a more ominous feature of any of the ANCA-associated vasculitides, which is diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. You can see blood around the pulmonary arteries and so forth. So it's this is a diffuse alveolar hemorrhage syndrome. And when we see this in just about any part of rheumatology, whether it's ANCA-associated vasculitis or lupus, the answer to the board question is plasma exchange is what we do. So other manifestations may include skin lesions, papules, vesicles, palpable purpura, nodules, and so forth. Cardiac involvement may occur with pericarditis, coronary vasculitis, or cardiomyopathy. CNS involvement with cranial neuritis, mononeuritis multiplex, like a foot drop, that sort of thing. Of course, constitutional symptoms. So what are the labs do we want to get? Which of these three do you like? What are you looking for if you order an ANA? Well, mostly you're looking for collagen vascular diseases, lupus, rheumatoid factor, mostly you're looking for RA. And ANCAs are associated with, well, mostly you're looking for three diseases. That is GPA, EGPA, and microscopic polyangiitis. In this case, we're looking for a PR3, anti-proteinase 3 antibody, and the C-ANCA. 90% of patients with granulomatosis with polyangiitis have a positive C-ANCA and anti-PR3, but the absence of active disease, this sensitivity drops to 60 or 70%. Often asked questions, if the ANCA goes down, does that mean the disease gets better or it's going away? Well, it may parallel disease activity in some individuals, but not all. So labs come back on this individual with positive cytoplasmic staining ANCA, an anti-PR3 antibody. He undergoes a renal biopsy, which shows PASI immune crescentic glomerulonephritis. So again, the vasculitides, the ANCA-induced, the ANCA-associated vasculitis group, are associated with with glomerulonephritis that does not have a lot of immune complexes in it, like lupus. So they're called PASI immune glomerulonephritis. So that, if you see it on a board question, is classical of one of these three diseases, such as GPA, all right? He started on dialysis, and treatment is initiated with cyclophosphamide and steroids, high-dose steroids. That's induction treatment, typically, for granulomatosis with polyangiitis. So I want to throw in this slide by Seo, and it's hard to know where to put this slide. I'm going to come back to ANCAs again, but this is a good way to just, you know, we can look at granulomatosis with polyangiitis, so-called Wegener's, microscopic polyangiitis, MPA, and EGPA, eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis. Previously, we called that Churg-Strauss, all right? But they're getting away more from names with all the diseases and trying to put in descriptive terms, all right? The antibody sensitivity for GPA is the PR3, and for the other two is MPO. Now, you're not always going to see an MPO. You'll see it about half the time, about 50% of the time with the other diseases. Histology is a little different. You'll see a leukocytoclasis and necrotizing granulomatous vasculitis with GPA, leukocytoclasis with MPA, but eosinophilic vasculitis with EGPA. ENT involvement is very common with GPA, absent or mild in MPA. And then what we see in EGPA is what you see in asthmatics. You know, you see nasal polyps, that sort of thing, allergic rhinitis. Those are the people that have the history of late onset allergic conditions. In the lungs, you can see nodules with GPA, cavitary lesions, and hemorrhage. In MPA, the classical presenting finding, and I remember the residents that are here from our institution, a very interesting case of drug-induced ANCA vasculitis with diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. And then, of course, with EGPA, they get asthma, infiltrates, and eosinophilic vasculitis. Kidney, all remarkably similar, again, PASI immune, eosinophils, occasionally mild in GPA, none in MPA, and EGPA, as the name would suggest, very high eosinophil counts. We've had cases with 25% of the peripheral smear being EOS. GPA with proper treatment, about 75%, may have complete remission. The most effective treatment for a life-threatening disease is cyclophosphamide or Rituxan with high-dose glucocorticoids. Rituximab is non-inferior to Cytoxan for induction. Cyclophosphamide-related toxicity, well, of course, if you give it daily oral, the one we really worry about is hemorrhagic cystitis and bladder cancer. After the age of 30, you can pretty much bet that there's going to be ovarian failure in women in whom you give it. Following induction of remission, we can maintain, usually once we achieve remission, after 3 to 6 months of remission therapy, induction therapy, we can maintain it with our old friend methotrexate, azathioprine, rituximab, or mycophenolate mofetil. For limited disease, you can use just maybe methotrexate for sinus disease. For pulmonary hemorrhage, that's, you know, check on the exam, plasma exchange, and move on. Subglottic stenosis is a dreaded complication of this disease, occurs in about 15%. Intralesional injections, dilatations, steroid injections like Kenalog, mitomycin I've seen used in some of our patients into the subglottic stenosis. This can be quite severe. I mean, and doesn't have to get down to like, 20 or 30%. If it gets down to about 50% stenosis, there's huge, these patients will have stridor, they have hoarseness. So these are very serious complications. And we can use trimethoprim, sulfamethoxazole trimethoprim, as pneumocystis drovici pneumonia prophylaxis. Typically don't use full dose, particularly if they're on methotrexate, maybe once a day. Okay. So our patient had to go on dialysis. He was given cyclophosphamide for induction, et cetera, and steroids. What would be a good drug for maintenance for him? Anybody want to keep him on cyclophosphamide? No. That's for, you know, we transition off that. Azathioprine, reasonable choice. Prednisone, no. Prednisone doesn't alter the course of the disease. And methotrexate might be a good choice. But the best choice here is azathioprine. Guidelines now is that you can use rituximab. Rituximab seems to be very good maintenance treatment for these individuals. Methotrexate's good too, but since he's on dialysis, we're going to have to avoid methotrexate because he's got a creatinine clearance of less than 10, let's say. Okay, last case. 62-year-old male with diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, coronary artery disease. He's on a lot of meds, metformin, lisinopril, hydralazine, metoprolol, aspirin, avoristatin. He has renal failure, acute renal failure. His vital signs are stable, lungs are clear. He has no murmur. He has lower extremity edema. He has macular, papular, purpuric rash, I should say, on the lower extremities. His creatinine over the past month has gone from 1.1 to 3.5. He's anemic. His sed rate's 113. He's got red cell and white cells and casts, cellular casts. So we have a differential diagnosis of diabetic nephropathy, medication-induced AKA, systemic lupus, and ANCA vasculitis. So what medication on this list might be a culprit? Well, the one that we're really looking at, or from our point of view these days, is hydralazine. Not only drug-induced lupus, but we're seeing a lot of drug-induced ANCA vasculitis. All right. So since this is a lecture on vasculitis, that turned out to be the answer. All right. Anti-neutrophilic cytoplasmic antibodies can be directed against either MPO or PR3. All right. There are two patterns, the cytoplasmic pattern, and again, the major target is PR3, and the perinuclear pattern, where the major target is myeloperoxidase. These reside in xerophilic vacuoles in neutrophils, and they can get exposed to the cytoplasm in certain conditions. And when they are, that's how we make antibodies to them. These are what the patterns look like. So this is a C ANCA. You can see the dark, the green is the cytoplasm taking up the immunofluorescent stain. And you can see the multilobulated nuclei are not. And then in the perinuclear pattern here, you can see that the stain is just taken up around the nuclei. P ANCAs can be drug-induced. In that first line, we're seeing a lot of it, hydralazine, PTU, and minocycline. Those are kind of the common three. We don't use d-penicillamine much anymore. I mean, we don't use it to treat RA. But any of the drugs on this list can cause a drug-induced ANCA. Typically, P ANCAs are associated with anti-MPO antibodies on ELISA. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. And if you have the anti-MPO, again, more indicative of a true vasculitis. Now, atypical ANCAs can occur and may be confused with P ANCAs. But typically, if it's a true P ANCA, or the MPO is going to be positive, and the PR3 is going to be positive in a C ANCA. So we see these atypical ANCAs in other connective tissue diseases. We can see it in inflammatory bowel disease and autoimmune hepatitis. But again, when you're ordering an ANCA, you're pretty much looking for a vasculitis, one of the three that we discussed. So on our case, labs are positive for P ANCA and MPO. Hydralazine was discontinued. Steroids were initiated. His renal function declined. Kidney biopsy again showed what? Pauci immune necrotizing crocenocomyelonephritis. I can't emphasize that enough. Cyclophosphamide was added, and he eventually had return of his renal function, which was not is not that common. So a little more on digressed hydralazine. Appears to be coming back and becoming very, very popular drug to use. It is associated with ANCA-associated vasculitis. And one review of anti-MPO, ANCA-associated vasculitis due to hydralazine showed 9 of 10 cases had renal involvement. The second most common presentation was skin. Most patients had both. All right. Atypical ANCAs may also be associated with drug-induced vasculitis. Okay, so which drug on this list doesn't cause an ANCA-associated vasculitis? PTU, methimazole, minocycline, levoquin, or isoniazid INH? And the answer is levoquin. All the rest of these are associated with ANCA-associated vasculitis. Okay, actually, happy to finish that one in exactly a half hour, so that's good. Now, there are other vasculitis I can comment, but we don't see them as much anymore. We don't see PAN that much. Hepatitis B, since the vaccines, we see much, much less of it than I used to see when I was in my training back in the 80s and so forth. Those, what you'll see on exams, what you'll see in clinical practice, you will see giant cell arteritis, of course, and you will see the ANCA-associated vasculitis.